Today's Teisho will be on case 40 in the Blue Rock collection, Nonsense This Flower. Engo's introduction. When the action of the mind is stopped and swept away, the iron tree will bloom. Can you demonstrate it? Even a crafty fellow will come short here. Even if he excels in every way, he will still have his nostrils pierced. What are the complications? See the following. Main subject. Riku Taifu, while talking with Nansen, said, Jo Hoshi said, Heaven and earth and I are of the same root. All things and I are of one substance. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? Nansen pointed to a flower in the garden, called Taifu to him, and said, People of these days see this flower as though they were in a dream. Secho's verse. Hearing, seeing, touching, and knowing are not one and one. Mountains and rivers should not be viewed in the mirror. The frosty sky, the setting moon at midnight. With whom will the serene waters of the lake reflect the shadows in the cold? I would like to thank you all very much for coming to practice this morning on this beautiful June morning. Really like the perfect day out there, so beautiful. Some of you have just now arrived, and I'm very glad that you could make it today. And some of you came a little earlier, I came at 9:30. And some of you came at 7. And if you've been sitting for a while in this room, we've been here in the dark meditating. If you started at 7, we've done 5 periods of meditation. And if you started at 9:30, 2. And after even 2 periods of meditation, your body can be a little tired and your mind can be a little tired. And then we get off the cushion and go to the bathroom, and then we do our walking meditation. And, you know, go outside and walk that circle. I don't know about you, but for me, when we do that, it's not always possible to do that because of, when school is in session, probably that wouldn't be possible. But when school's out of session and we're really pretty much alone here on the whole campus on a Saturday morning, it's really wonderful to go out there and walk. And I don't know about you, but everything seems so intensely alive. So, coming from this room where the air conditioner is a little difficult to adjust, we walk outside and, the shadows feel very cool. And then you step into the sunlight and the sunlight feels very warm. And I don't know if it's just me, but probably you might have noticed that too, you know. The shadows feel really shadowy, really cool. And you get out in the sun, and the sun feels really, really hot, really sunny. And then, you know, we walk down towards the circle, and the linden trees are so beautiful. When you notice them, you know, we're all sort of looking down because we're doing kinhin, but you notice the linden trees, and you notice the rich shadows. And the colors of the linden leaves, you know, gray underneath and green on top. It's almost, I don't know why, but it seems like every leaf seems very distinct, you know. And then we do our walk, and the shadows are so rich and cool, and the sunny patches are so warm. And you can hear sounds of birds, and they all sound very clear and crisp. There's something about those moments that something about them, you know, it's really special. They're so present. They're so clear and present. And as we do our walk, you know, each step slowly walking, see a little little finch or a little nuthatch on the ground, and see the grass, see the flowers in the pots. As we go around, you might see the high clouds in the blue sky. And everything stands out very keenly, very clearly and crisply. I don't know about you, but that's how it was for me this morning. And I think meditation has a lot to do with that. And that intensely present quality to everything. It's really beautiful. You know, if you were coming here on your way to a busy class, you might not notice any of this. You know, your mind might be full of thoughts and just buzzing with thoughts, or you might be trying to work through some problem in your mind, or you might be imagining events that are going to happen, or events that have happened. Maybe you're worried about having, you know, coming back to the meter and feeding the meter for your car, or maybe you didn't quite get everything done in time for class and you're hoping the professor won't call on you, or whatever. You know, maybe you have some unpaid bills. And you could walk by all of this and not even notice it. You know, or it would be very indistinct, sort of like a, just like a backdrop that you don't pay much attention to, you know. And it can all be rather fuzzy and indistinct. A few weeks ago, I mentioned that a reporter for the Washington Post had tried an experiment. He had gotten one of the foremost violinists in the United States to perform in the D.C. subway. And he was convinced that when people busily rushing to work heard Joshua Bell play, they would be arrested in their tracks and would look over and think, what is that heavenly music? And to his amazement, Joshua Bell played like, I don't remember how many hours, but a substantial portion of time, not a single person stopped to listen to the music. Not a single one. One person stopped, I guess, for a couple of minutes, or even less than that. Just looked and then walked away. Brilliant music, brilliant musician, and people were really unable to appreciate it. Today, after a morning of Zazen, when you go outside, it becomes possible to really experience the world in its real beauty and presence. You know, this world is so precious. It's so beautiful. Every once in a while we get a glimpse of that beauty, you know, that preciousness. Often we have to go far away, you know. People will, and there's nothing wrong with this, you know, at all, but, you know, people will go to like Yellowstone or Yosemite or to someplace special, and then they can see it, you know. You get out of your rut, you get out of your everyday routine, and you go someplace else, and it's possible sometimes to see the specialness of everything, you know. Sometimes people see it by accident. You know, you're on your way to some place and you're in a hurry, and suddenly you look and you see the wind blowing through the summer trees, and your mind just comes for just a moment, perhaps, just comes to a stop. All thoughts just come to a stop, and you're sort of absorbed into the pure presentness of the moment. And at those moments, usually, we feel great. You know, we feel so happy. We feel safe. It's like being connected to the world. Those moments are the reason people go on vacations, and they're the reason people do all kinds of things. They're very rare, you know, but when they happen, they're so wonderful. Now, as I say, you know, a lot of people go sort of ritualistically to other places to have these kinds of experiences, but the truth is, you know, Yellowstone or anywhere else, Hawaii or California, you know, really, the moment there isn't much different from the moment here. It's really the truth. You know, so people might, if you said, well, I think New Jersey's as good as Montana, people might not believe you, you know. But on a day like today, if you've done some zazen and you go out and you just walk under these linden trees, you know, couldn't be any better if you were in, you know, Kathmandu or anywhere else. That's the truth, right? The pure presentness of this moment is so beautiful. It's so perfect. You couldn't add to it, right? So maybe you had just a little taste of that this morning. But that's really the object of our practice. You know, it's not always possible to be with the moment in all of its beauty. But that beauty is always here. It's always here. Let's face it, it's easier to experience it, you know, when the campus is empty, and if we were doing our kinhin in the parking lot of a mall, of Menlo Park Mall, it might be harder. But you know, you might have had a moment, you know, where, you know, it's the end of a busy week, you're going to Menlo Park Mall because there's a movie on, the sun is setting, it's summer, late summer day, and you just suddenly feel joy, you know, as you're moving through the cars. You know, you said, yeah, it's so wonderful to be alive. You know, even then, you know, that's like parking lot samadhi. You know, it's like the pure presence of the moment. Even then can be just really deeply, it's a big relief, isn't it, to really be connected to the universe. So, today, everybody came in here and we did our zazen and we purified our body, mind, and heart. This is one way to think about what we're doing. You know, you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, or you call Mu, and your mind is so full of concerns, thoughts, dreams, ideas, disappointments, aspirations, you know, you name it. And this is the ordinary human state, right? Pulled in a million directions, constantly preoccupied. And, you know, that's how people normally live their lives, you know. I love that song by, it could be the state anthem of New Jersey. I love that song by Bruce Springsteen, Everybody has a Hungry Heart, you know? I won't sing it for you today. I'm sure you know it. Or I hope you know it. My cultural references, the popular cultural references, are so old sometimes that I don't. But, you know, that should be the state anthem of New Jersey, because people in New Jersey have a really hungry heart, you know? Everybody wants a gigantic house. Everybody wants a foreign car. You know, really, it's like people have huge appetites, don't they? It's amazing. And, you know, everybody wants just about everything. And everybody is just a little disappointed as a result, you know? Because even if you get the gigantic house out in the Jersey suburbs, and you are the envy of all your neighbors, you know, you lie awake at night and you think, you know, if I don't make the payments on this place, what's going to happen to me? In fact, you know, actually, this is, this happens to people all the time. On my street, I there are some houses that are rather small, and there are some houses that are medium sized, and there are some houses that are like palaces almost. And it's a nice neighborhood where I live. It's in Plainfield. And you know, I and my wife bought our house in Plainfield in 1993, I think. And the market, housing market, was depressed. So we got a very nice house for about $150,000, which it sounds like a lot of money. And at the time we bought the house, I laid awake at night thinking, how are we ever going to pay this off? But the housing market has gone through the roof. If you're looking for a house, if you're in that stage of your life, houses are incredibly expensive. And down the street, there's a very large, lovely house, and two friends of ours bought it, John and Patrick. And Patrick was talking to me, and he was just telling me how difficult it was to make his mortgage payments. And you know, I didn't say, well, how, what are they? But he told me, you know, he said he has to pay like $3,600 or $3,700, maybe more. I can't remember the exact figure, but it's almost $4,000 a month. It's like, I remember when I used to pay $80 a month for my apartment. Really, I mean, when I, you know, $4,000 a month, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God, that's, and he goes to work on Sundays. You know, he's in the real estate business in New York City, and he you know, I get up and sit every day. I do meditation. I wouldn't miss it for the world. And then I sometimes go for a jog or a jog walk. And I always go by the backyard of their house, and I can sometimes see Patrick in the backyard at like, you know, 6:30 in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning, sitting in his backyard chain smoking. And he must be so frightened and worried, you know. It's a hungry heart, you know. You know, the house couldn't be more beautiful. It's the quote-unquote house of your dreams, right? You know, it's this beautiful Victorian house. It's got floor-to-ceiling windows. When you go in, you feel like you're in a masterpiece theater movie, right? It's like the BBC. It's like the world of British grandeur or something. You know, it's just so beautiful. And, you know, they must have seen this house and imagined all the dreams that they were going to have. The wonderful lives, you know, the dinner parties. And indeed, those will probably happen, but, you know, my friend sits in the back of his house chain-smoking in the morning, and he goes to work on Sundays, and he's terrified he can't make his payments on this house. You know, so hungry heart, you know, this is like the human way, right? And I know people who, you know, they are like intellectuals, academic scholars, and so on. And they get journal articles in the mail in their field, you know, and they look through the articles in the footnotes to see if anybody has cited their work. Really. And you might think that's crazy, but if you're a scholar, this is so important to you, right? Because you might work for 3 or 4 months on an article, maybe more, maybe even 6 months, and you write it and revise it and you send it off, and then, you know, it goes to a reader, an editor, and the editor might suggest further changes. You finally get it into print. It might be 3 years since the time you started working on it, you know, and it's like, it's like throwing a stone into a cave. You just wonder, you know, where did it go, you know? And so you open up your latest copy of your journal and you look and say, did anybody read my thing? You know? And you know, it's quite possible nobody did. And there are people I know who are literally have like developed personality disorders because, really, it's so common, you know. You know who suffers from this intensely is poets. You know, I have friends of mine who are poets, and poets, you know, the readership for poetry in the United States is so small. There are some people who are really brilliant poets. You know, in South America or Russia, people really take poets seriously. If you say, I'm a poet, people, you know, oh, really? You know, step this way, you know. In America, it's like a joke, right? You know, I'm a poet. You're kidding me, you know. And so I have friends who are just like brilliant poets. I read their work and I think, that is so beautiful. That must have taken hundreds of hours to get right, you know. Literally, and you know, they publish these books, and they get awards from other poets. But if the books sell 300 copies, it's a miracle, right? And so some of these people have they go down in their basement and they have like their collected works in the basement. You know, these are like the books that the press couldn't sell, so they have like boxes of their remaindered books in their basement. And such people, you know, can eat their hearts out. You know, it's like, oh, you know, how can the universe be so unkind to me, you know? So, you know, we have a hungry heart. We want so much. You know, what we want is to write those poems, and it's a noble aspiration. It's not selfish, really, to give your life to art and to ask other people to look. I think there's nothing wrong with that. You know, but it's another form of human hunger, right? You know, we want to be creative. We want people to notice. We want people to say, hey, this is a beautiful poem. Who are you? You know, you're doing wonderful work. Keep it up, you know. And life doesn't always do that. You know, so a lot of people go around with a hungry heart. My sister-in-law is an artist, and I'm not kidding. Some of her stuff I don't like. She has like two styles, and there's one style I just can't stand, and literally, you know. But she has this other style that's just, I think, magnificent. It's like when she's not, she's like has this crazy style that I just can't stand, and then she has this other style that's very beautiful, I think, and really in the moment. You know, it's not so imaginative. It's just in the she did a picture of some geese that she painted, this oil painting of geese that we have in our house. We used to have sashin there, and some of you might remember it. It's on the wall. It's two geese, and it's just beautiful. The presence of the geese is so powerful. But you know, she has shows where if she sells a single painting or a couple paintings, it's a big victory for her, and her house is full of paintings that nobody bought, and they're really wonderful. I mean, really wonderful. So this is sort of it's possible in life to be very disappointed or very unhappy or very distracted. We all have aspirations. We all have big plans, and when you come in and sit on the cushion, sometimes it's a little hard at first to appreciate just the sheer beauty of being alive, you know, just the sheer beauty of being alive. You know, we just get a little too caught up in the dream, you know, in all of these dreams. So some of you today, if you read the New York Times, might notice there's a story in today's New York Times. When I got up this morning, I get up pretty early, just generally. I got up around 4:30 this morning, and I had a cup of tea, and since I was going to sit, I didn't sit. I read the New York Times. And there's an article in the New York Times today about how in Oakland, California, they're starting to use meditation in the classrooms. And apparently fifth graders, this is a little story, and it says that fifth graders at Piedmont Avenue Elementary School here closed their eyes and focused on their breathing. as I and they're using a kind of meditation called loving kindness meditation, metta meditation. One of the children interviewed was named Alex Menton. He's 11. He said, "I was losing at baseball and I was about to throw a bat," Alex Menton, 11, reported to his classmates the next day. "The mindfulness really helped. I just think that's great. I think this is wonderful." Apparently, they're using this throughout the day to help people deal with the complexity of our lives. You know, we're a little bit like, I think humans are a little bit like magicians who enchant themselves or put a spell on themselves. You know, we have so many things to preoccupy our minds, mm-hmm. and we make so many more. You know, really, existence is, I think, rather simple. You know, you need to have something to eat. People have a deep need for friendship and companionship. You need a place to sleep, you know, simple. But we complicate it in all sorts of ways. I can't really imagine what it's like to be a little kid today. You know, when I was growing up, we had very few diversions, really. You know, very few. There was television then. When I was young, television actually already existed. And but TV then was really stupid. You know, like incredibly stupid. There used to be a show called Mr. Ed about a talking horse. Some of you may have seen it on Nick at Night, right? And the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, this kind of stuff. So TV was like really dumb. And movies, you know, weren't like, it wasn't like today where these blockbusters are on the movies every 2 weeks. You know, there. When I was growing up, there would be like a blockbuster every half year. So there was a movie called Cleopatra, with a famous actress named Elizabeth Taylor, who was thought to be very beautiful in her time, and Richard Burton, who was a alcoholic British Shakespearean actor, who they were married and spent obscene amounts of money on one another, bought each other gigantic diamonds and. And they were in this movie called Cleopatra about ancient Egypt. If you ever see it, it's literally ridiculous, right? But that was a huge hit. And I remember it was on for 6 months. Another movie was called The Sound of Music. Maybe some of you have seen that. But when I was a little boy, that was a huge hit. And it started playing maybe in the theaters in June. And you'd drive by the theater, usually like in any town there was like one theater. And you'd drive by the theater and June, the marquee would say Sound of Music. July, Sound of Music. August, Sound of Music. September, Sound of Music, right? And people would just keep going to the same movie, you know. The studios just couldn't produce enough, you know, they just didn't produce like a blockbuster every 2 weeks. You know? So you had a lot of downtime when nothing in particular was going on. You could go out and play baseball. I lived on a base, military base, and I used to just go for long walks in the woods. It was like unstructured time. And I think kids now have very little of that. You know, they have video games. I don't have to go through the whole list with you, you know. But I myself have actually never played a video game. And it's not that I've never played one and I don't even know how, you know. But you have video games, CDs, you have iPods. I've never operated an iPod, but you have all this stuff going on, you know. And it's busy, 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 busy. And the pace is very intense. And everything gets filled up. It's like there are no open spaces anymore. And people are, I think, just pulled along by their fantasies. You know, we create this imaginary world of culture And, you know, we find ourselves worried about you can actually find yourself worried about your score on a video game. You know, you could get mad about it, really be upset. You know, you can say, well, it's just a game. You know, it's just a fantasy. But so many things in life are like that. You know, we think they're so important, and they're like dreams that have enchanted us, and we toss and turn at night in our beds, you know, and wish we were in another world, you know, or we cry because we are not the people we want to be, and so on. You know, every human has this hungry heart, you know, and we create these dreams, and they don't necessarily set us free, you know. A lot of the time, we get our dream, even when we get our dreams, we find we're not where we want to be, you know. We're somehow unfree, you know, somehow unhappy. And, you know, meditation is really kind of a unique experience because it's, you know, we're cultivating a kind of consciousness that has no object, you know, has no purpose. It's just being in the moment. You know, we're not trying to achieve anything in particular. You know, it's a very different kind of experience, and I think it's very liberating. You know, really uniquely liberating to sort of break out of this dream, if just for a minute, which is, you know, the dream is like a. I don't know if you ever had a dream like this, but. You can have a dream that starts out pretty well and it gradually turns into a nightmare sort of dream, right? You know, where it starts out okay and then suddenly you're being chased and you try to fly away by flapping your arms and you can't fly away. And maybe you haven't had that kind of a dream, but I think a lot of our dreams can be like that, you know? You think, here's how my life is going to be, and if it doesn't turn out that way, it's like, how could this happen to me? I can't believe this is happening to me. Or you can say, I want to be an English professor. You can get your PhD and get the job, and then you write these articles that nobody reads, and it can be quite disappointing. You know, life can be quite disappointing. And then you can eat your heart out. You can start drinking, or you can, you know, have a series of divorces, whatever you would like, but it really doesn't help, you know. I was, millions of Americans, recently, I came home from a meditation, and like millions of Americans, don't sit, unfortunately, but after the sit, I did what millions of Americans did about a week ago, and I turned on the TV and watched the last episode of The Sopranos. And I have to tell you, I haven't really watched The Sopranos in years. When it first came on, I actually watched it and thought it was great. I thought, this is really fantastic. And then after like the first season, I just don't have time, you know. Because I like to sit, and I have a job, it's pretty busy, and so I just don't watch, you know, I just lost interest. But I did watch this last one, and I loved the ending, you know, because things are just not working out for Tony, you know, and he's tried to, you know, make his dreams real. And it's required like a lot of violence, and this is obvious, right? I mean, Tony wants to live in a nice New Jersey house. He's got like a $1 million home, you know, and he has all the amenities of an accomplished life, but he's had to do it in like a really bad way. And everybody was wondering about how the show would end. And probably you've seen it or you won't blame me if I give away the ending, I hope. But, you know, we're worried that he's going to get assassinated, you know. And he meets his family in a restaurant, and he's waiting for his daughter Meadow to come. And she keeps having trouble parallel parking. her trouble parallel parking seems to build a kind of tension, right? Because we're waiting for her to go into the restaurant and meet Tony and Carmela and AJ. And she can't seem to get her car in this place. And meanwhile, Tony's watching people in the restaurant because any one of them might be an assassin, right, to kill him. Or it might be a federal agent who's just about to arrest him. So there's this tremendous tension that's building up, right? And then, I think Meadow comes in, and Tony is having a conversation with his son, and he offers him some French fries. And we see this guy go into the bathroom who might be a hitman. Right? And at that moment, we're waiting for something to happen. And the screen just goes black, right? And like millions of other people, for a minute I just said, oh my God, HBO has made a terrible mistake. Right? I can't believe that this is happening. And then the credits started rolling. And I thought, that is so cool. That is so cool. And I think that's a very Zen ending. I mean, I'm sure everybody looks at that through his own filter, right? You know, somebody else is saying this is a very such and such ending. You know, this, but I couldn't. I thought, man, that is the essence of Zen. You know, really. You know, because the blank screen, you know, is always there. You know, it's something we just don't want to come to terms with. You know, it's always there. And, you know, when we sit on the cushion, you know, our mind doesn't want to be, it doesn't want to go to the blank screen. It wants to be filled with ideas and amusements and entertainments and dreams and aspirations and fears. And you watch the breath and you watch the breath and you watch the breath, and every once in a while, there's like a moment where your mind is just blank. Or blank and dark. There's just nothing there. Oh, and then it starts again. It's like the machine starts, the dream machine starts revving up. You know, every once in a while, the dream machine goes, but, nothing. And then, you know, just for a second, there's that blank screen. Now let me. If you don't mind, I'd like to let you in on another secret besides the ending of The Sopranos. You know, actually, the blank screen may really be there really, really all the time, or at least it may be there in consciousness all the time. If you sit long enough, if you sit for, say, 10 years or 15 years or so, your mind is going to become so observant and so keenly aware and so calm and still that you're going to begin to notice, and it may not take 15 years. Somebody talked to me about this just the other day who had only been sitting for a little while. But, you know, actually, reality is not, reality is the human mind experiences it, and possibly reality itself. It's hard to distinguish. But reality, as the human mind experiences it, is not continuous, or consciousness is not continuous. In other words, you know, if you go to a movie theater, when I was growing up, we used to go to the Base Theater, and they had this old projector on the base, and they would play movies like Zorba the Greek, and these old 1960s or 1950s movies. And every once in a while, the projector would start acting up, and it would get out of sync. And instead of seeing a continuous stream of images on the screen, you'd see like flashing images. So some Lee Marvin would come into the room with a bottle of whiskey in his hand, and then instead of walking across the room, you'd get Lee Marvin, and then blank, and then Lee Marvin, and then blank, and then Lee Marvin, and then blank. And everybody would start shouting, and the projector would go off, and then they'd fix it and turn it back on, and you get the continuous movie again. It was just like The Sopranos, right? you know, what's wrong with you, you know? You know, but the truth is, you know, if you meditate long enough, you begin to notice that consciousness isn't continuous, that there are indeed these blank spaces between the moments. This is not something we're manufacturing. It's actually there. That the moment comes, and it's very fresh at first, and then it gets solidifies. The moment at first is just pure presence, just like after you sit. And then thinking arises, and the moment becomes a little bit more rigid. And then you have an emotional response, and the moment becomes very blurry. And then, believe it or not, there's like this blank space for, at first people just can't even notice it. But when you meditate long enough and the mind becomes calm and still, you begin to fall into these blank spaces once in a while. But you're not imagining them. They're really part of consciousness. See, they really are. So consciousness isn't continuous. The moment is like a wave, and then the wave goes up and it goes down, and in the trough of the wave there's just blankness. And then there's another moment, and then there's blankness. So it's like the movie projector. It's like something, nothing, something, nothing, something, nothing. Now this is how consciousness really works, but it may actually be how reality works. You know, in other words, the universe may be oscillating like this. You know, sounds crazy, but actually I've read physicists who say the same thing, that the universe is constantly oscillating between something and nothing. We don't notice it because it's not to our, you know, it's not something people normally notice. But maybe that reality is not like continuous. It really is like pulses. Well, whether reality is like that, or we know if you sit long enough, consciousness is like that. See? It's like this something, nothing. And when you begin to sit on the cushion, you know, you begin to have experiences of this nothingness, which is actually right at the heart of consciousness. It's like the source of, actually the nothing is the source of the something. That might not make any sense right now, but if you keep practicing, it will begin to make a lot of sense. And the strange thing is that, you know, we get so caught up in the something. We get so, you know, we get, if you cling too much to the something, you know, you can turn into a Tony Soprano. It's really true. You know, if you can't liberate yourself from your fantasies, you can do some terrible things sometime. Or you can be terribly unhappy, you know, and you get terribly lost in all of these, all of this noise, all of this, the culture, all of its messages, all of the diversions, all of the temptations, you know, it's just a madhouse, right? It's like we enchant ourselves and then we get lost in our enchantments. But you stumble into this blankness, and suddenly it's like you turn off the TV and there's the blank screen, right? And most people are terrified of the blank screen. They're frightened of it. Because after all, you know, it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing to be gained, you know. And it really does. It assigns to everything we do a kind of value of absolute zero, right? It says, this was all a dream. This was all, you know, just all a dream. You know? And that's terrifying to people. But it is just all a dream in a certain way, yeah? It is just all a dream. There's something about this human world which is very dreamlike. And the problem is we get trapped in these dreams and we can't awaken from them, and we toss and turn in our beds and we cry and we bitterly resent our lives, which are so precious and beautiful. But, you know, if your thing is Zen, you know, if you do Zen, you come in and you sit on the cushion, and little by little you just stumble into this blankness. And as I say, most people are terrified. You know, when that screen went dark, millions of Americans were screaming in their living rooms. And I think the reaction was so powerful, not just because you interrupted the story, or people wanted to know how it ends, because of course it actually, nothing ever ends, right? No matter what happens, it all goes on. Like the song said, the journey song, but which not everybody's a Journey fan. I guess, you know. But as the song was playing, it goes on and on and on. The fantasy go on. The fantasy machine runs forever, right? The dream machine runs forever. But that blank screen is you know, seemed like the worst thing that could happen. But you know, in a certain way, encountering that blankness is the best thing that can happen to a person. You know, because I think it's so liberating. It's so liberating, you know, actually, to get up and just turn off your TV and go outside and look at the stars. You know, it's so liberating. And it's just, you know, you find yourself actually worried about Tony Soprano. You know, and you find Tony Soprano doesn't exist. You know, he's a fantasy. There is no Tony Soprano. You know, I don't know if you ever, long ago, when I was in college, so probably or a little after the time I was in college, there was a wonderful Saturday Night Live skit where it showed Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock on the Enterprise. And they were going through space, and then suddenly a person in a suit walks onto the Enterprise and says, "Listen, I'm sorry, but the show has been canceled." And Captain Kirk is still giving orders. He goes, "What? Can't? No, that's impossible." And he goes, "Scotty, keep going, you know." and anyway, the other actors are looking embarrassed, you know, and they start leaving the stage, you know, and then the guys come in to dismantle the, you know, they take the equipment down, and Kirk won't leave. You know. This is so human, isn't it? You know, but we're so afraid of that empty stage, you know, suddenly every once in a while it does happen to people, right? You suddenly realize that this isn't real. I don't have to be afraid, I don't have to be worried, I don't have to hate myself. It's very rare that we're so caught up in the spell, but every once in a while you suddenly realize this doesn't have to be the way it is. You know, this is not real. But when you sit on the cushion, you really encounter that, and I think it's just tremendously liberating. You know, tremendously liberating. You know, all the people in The Sopranos are running, I think, from the blank screen. And it's peeking through every once in a while. And you know, Tony sort of knows that, right? Tony, every once in a while, Tony has glimpses of a different way of living, right? He has little glimpses of, he knows this isn't real. You know, this is like a feverish dream. But he can't find a way out. He can't get out of it. You know, he goes to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist doesn't know the way out either. You know, and I think, David Chase is like a genius. I think he's just taking us through these loops that play and replay, and the terrible violence and the terrible unhappiness. And when you see the blank screen, you suddenly realize all of this is totally unnecessary. You know, all of this suffering is so unnecessary. And actually, the best thing people could have done is just when they, as the credits roll, just turn the TV off. And it's not the problem is TV. It's the mind. You know? So you turn the TV off and just sit looking at a blank screen for a while. It's a wonderful thing. And very precious, right? Opportunities to practice like this are really very precious. I think probably in Oakland, California, this experiment isn't going to last. You know, I think probably somebody's going to file a lawsuit and say, this is a public university and you can't teach a Buddhist meditation practice. And they have a point, you know. Or some other religious group will sue and say, this is special pleading. And then that'll be the end of that experiment. But in the meantime, you know, some kids are going to have the opportunity to experience something really wonderful. And everything is constantly changing, but I think we were all very lucky today to be able to turn off the TV in our minds and rediscover just how beautiful life can really be. When the action of the mind is stopped, see, the dream machine, blub 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 blub. Just a second. Blah, 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 blah. When the action of the dream machine is stopped, even a tree made out of iron can bloom. See, our hearts become so frozen, right? Just like an iron tree. It'll never bloom in a million years. But when the dream machine just stops just for a little bit, our hearts break. That, you know, buds in our hearts open up, flowers open up, you know. Can you demonstrate it? Even a brilliant person, you know, even very smart people are taken in by the dream, see. Spend their lives rolling in their beds, you know, in anxiety and disappointment. You know, even if you're excellent, even if you're the top in your field in every way, you'll have your nostrils pierced. Who has his nostrils pierced? An animal that's led around by the nose, see? People, you know, you might think, well, Bill Gates is free. You know, maybe not, see? Even Bill Gates might be like a bull being led around by the nose, see? Real freedom is not being taken in by the dream. So he says, see the following. Riku Taifu, while talking with Nansen, said, Joe Hoshi said, heaven and earth and I have the same root. All things and I are of one substance. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? So he says, you know, this great Zen master has said everything has the same root. And Nansen says to this guy, basically, I don't think you know what that root is yet. You know, it's a nice idea, but have you encountered the blank screen? See, have you encountered the blank screen? If not, you're just a dreamer trapped in his own dream. You know, when people first sit on the cushion and they encounter... I'll stop. I know it's going on. You know, when people sit on the cushion and they first encounter that blankness, you know, they just think, so what? You know. But the longer you stay in that blankness, the more you see this is the door to enlightenment. This is the door of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That blank screen, that blankness you encounter on the cushion is the most precious thing in the world. And if you decide to make Zen your way of life, you know, I get up every morning with, and I will until I'm dead, so help me. You know, I don't want to miss a, you know, you don't have to sit every day. My personal feeling is, life is too short not to sit. So I get up every day and I do Zazen. And I sit in front of that blank screen and I feel so alive and so happy to be alive, you know. It's the most precious thing in the world. And I'd like to tell you more about it, but I have to stop. Secho's verse, hearing, seeing, touching, and knowing are not one and one. Mountains and rivers should not be viewed in the mirror. See? See them directly. When you see them through your ideas and preconceptions, it's like looking in a it's like looking at everything through a mirror, through a distorting mirror. The frosty sky, the setting moon at midnight, with whom will the serene waters of the lake reflect the shadows and the cold? Please encounter your true nature in this this beautiful, serene, blank mind.